This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Big data is getting bigger every day. Every internet search, GPS query, text message, credit and debit card transaction becomes part of a vast data set stored in corporate, institutional, and government servers, hoping to mine the data for information. And it's just getting bigger. 90% of the data that exists has been generated in the past 3 years. We've all heard about how our digital footprints compromise our privacy and security. But in a new book, futurist and science writer Patrick Tucker urges us not to fear big data. He advocates for harnessing that data to level the playing field and make the powerful more accountable. His new book, The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move, is filled with examples of how citizens can use data to help them live much healthier lives, realize personal goals more quickly, avoid inconvenience, convenience and danger, and increase our ability to accurately predict the future. Patrick is deputy editor for The Futurist and technology editor for Defense One. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Patrick, you are a futurist, perhaps a little braver than most of us about where technology is bringing us. Early in the book, you write that big data is not them, it's us. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, we are the origin point for all of the data that we create, and we do create a lot of it with all of our music streaming particularly, but also our posting, our tweeting, and all of our digital interactions we create on the order of 1.8 million megabytes of data on a yearly basis. And to sort of put that in real terms, that's about the equivalent of 9 CD-ROMs a day. Now, not all of it is stored forever. In fact, only about 10% of it is. And a lot of it, like I said, is related to streaming and other activities like that. But all of it says something about you, and you created it. And we're going to reach a point, I argue, in the very near future where instead of feeling like all of that data exists somewhere else solely for use by other parties, by other entities, by invisible folks we can't see that do things with it that we can't know, we're going to be able to use much more of it ourselves because, like I said, it's created through our digital interactions, and our digital interactions are increasingly all of our interactions.
So while many of us perceive data collected from us by Silicon Valley, the NSA, Madison Avenue, being out of our hands, you're writing about putting it back. And a key component in the ability to do this is the growth of the Internet and things and telemetry. So what do you mean by those things first? And give us an example of how those can be used in practical terms.
So the Internet of Things really refers to the computerization of our entire physical environment. 70% of the American population, according to the most recent Pew poll, now walks around with a supercomputer basically in their pocket compared to what computers were doing just a few years ago. So we connect with the Internet now all the time through stuff that we do, but that's not the only example of the Internet of Things. Cisco has anticipated that there's going to be 50 billion machine-to-machine devices communicating all around us in the year 2020. Which is pretty remarkable considering that we're only going to have about 7 billion human beings on the planet around that time. So they outnumber us, these machines that communicate to one another and take up space in our physical world, and that's the Internet of Things. But the amazing thing about it is that as the density of those types of machines grow, as there just gets to be more and more and more of them, our interaction with computers becomes increasingly passive. And what I mean by that is we don't notice that we're interacting with computers nearly so much, even if we are interacting with them more. And telemetry really refers to the constant act of creating data. So it's a medical term originally, and it refers to the taking of data from one place and moving it to another in something like real time. So in a hospital, telemetry takes the form of like the sensors that patients wear that communicate their biophysical signals to someone down the hall, like a doctor or a nurse. And we're going to have that sort of capability all around us in the future, where we're going to have a telemetric sense of what the world around us is doing, and we're going to be creating that telemetric data as well.
All right, let's help us make that jump from that passive generation of data to actually harnessing it. A couple of examples you give in the book are coming up with early warning systems for first responders, early earthquake warning systems that they're experimenting with in Japan. Another example, little Josh going to the school nurse. Can you walk us through?
Right, little Josh going to the school nurse. So Josh goes to the school nurse, and he's been pulled out of class. He doesn't know why. He feels just fine. But based on some of his geotag tweets and a couple of other pieces of data that he's created very recently, the nurse knows that he has a pretty good chance of contracting a flu later in the day because he's going to co-locate with one of his classmates in a science lab, and that person has the flu. So she checks him out, and she discovers that Josh is actually carrying a genetically novel flu type. And so they're able to call the CDC and get it marked. And next thing you know, the entire world is saved from a potential pandemic because of point-of-care diagnostics and also because of data transparency involving Josh. So this is based on it's sort of an extrapolation from a real-world experiment that ran. There were a couple of researchers, one from University of Rochester and some from Johns Hopkins. And what they did is they took a data set of about 600,000 tweets. These were geotag tweets in New York. And they ran them through a semantic analysis. So they looked at the words really carefully, and they taught a program to kind of understand the language in the tweets. And they separated out the tweets that were about being sick from the tweets that were about not being sick, or used the word sick sort of figuratively. And they found that after they did this, they employed an algorithm to look at the different probabilities, but they could anticipate 18% of the person-to-person flu transmissions that were going to occur among the people that they were looking at, among these geotagging tweeters. And that's pretty remarkable when you consider the enormous number of variables that go into predicting, like, who's going to give you the flu today? So what that looks like in the future is you getting a push notification on your phone, it looks like a little text message, telling you that you have a certain probability of getting someone else's flu later today. And that's part of the naked future. This is something that we can all look forward to, is all feeling a little bit better and avoiding interactions that we don't want to have.
Patrick Tucker is with us. He's a futurist and a writer and author of a book called The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Well, all right, so how far are we from this kind of app that can make that prediction? I mean, throughout the book, we meet engineers and hackers and entrepreneurs and scientists and citizens who you've interviewed that are trying to make these reality. I'm trying to understand how far we are from, you know, Fitbit reading our calories and tracking our sleep patterns to predicting the future.
Well, it's really a function of how many people pick up this behavior, and that correlates pretty roughly to the number of people that pick up smartphones, particularly in terms of geotagged tweeting. So I don't come up with, like, a really firm date, but I think that you can anticipate that when we get to the point where smartphone penetration in the United States reaches 100%, then this sort of capability is going to be open to far more people. But it really depends on your own behavior. If you're someone who geotagged tweets a lot, and you pay a lot of attention to your other friends that do that, then you're much more predictable than someone else. And what I argue is that that's probably an okay thing, so long as you understand all that goes into that. So it's not going to be sort of like a universal thing, but if you're already using Fitbit and you're already geotagging your tweets, then there's a ton of stuff you can start to predict about yourself already. So it's sort of like that great quote from William Gibson, the science fiction writer, "The future's already here, it's just not evenly distributed." For some people, this is already a reality, and I think for everybody else, it's something that feels more and more like reality in the next 10 years.
But putting that information out there, geolocating yourself, geotagging your tweets, showing people where you are and what you're doing, it requires a level of trust that we certainly don't have now. I mean, consider that insurance companies or prospective employers could know that you have type 1 diabetes because of the information that you put out there, or that you may have struggled with mental illness. This means that we have to know whose hands the information is going into in order to trust it. Or do we just have to redefine our notions of privacy?
Well, we have to do all of those things at the same time. And that's sort of the challenge of the next 10 years. We do have to redefine our notions of privacy, and we do have to first reconcile ourselves to something that's really inevitable, and that is that we're going to be creating much more data. We're going to be creating on the order of 44 times as much data in the year 2020 as we were in 2009. And we have to just surrender to that inevitability. Now, that's a little bit different from saying, I don't want anything that remotely resembles privacy anymore, but we do have to recreate it, and we do have to recreate it largely from scratch, because only by doing that can we move towards the best possible future, and that's really what I want for us.
Patrick Tucker, a futurist and science writer, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Patrick's new book is called The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. There are loads more examples in the book and reviews at wordofmouthradio.org. The World Wide Web turned 25 this month. Time to step out on its own. You may have heard murmurings about the U.S. ceding control of the Internet. Sounds kind of scary, right? Well, up next, we'll cut through the hyperbole and explain what the decision really means for the future of the Internet. But before that, a reminder that we're closing in on the final days of our March fund drive. Here at Word of Mouth, we work hard to go beyond the news headlines and the sound bites to give you a more nuanced view of the world and the abundant creativity within it, while sparking your curiosity, of course. But to continue to do that, we really do look to your support. Here is how you can help. Word of Mouth! This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have heard news this week that the U.S. is relinquishing control, quote-unquote, over the Internet. More specifically, that the Obama administration has decided not to renew its contract overseeing the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN. The decision has sparked a vocal backlash from some conservatives. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich tweeted, "Every American should worry about Obama giving up control of the Internet to an undefined group. This is very, very dangerous." But let's face it, most of us have no idea what ICANN does or is and how this decision will or will not change the way the Internet functions. Joining us to unpack it is Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at Zerocol and our chief explainer of all things Wired. Rob, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Virginia.
Well, so first of all, what does ICANN actually do?
Well, ICANN, as you said, is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and it oversees names, IP addresses, and protocols on the Internet. So in our world, perhaps the most important part are really the names, things like www.nhpr.org. And what ICANN does is they watch over the root and top-level domains. So what that means is the org portion and what is above it, or the root of the DNS tree. DNS is the domain name system where all these names live. So for a long time, that organization has reported into an organization called the NTIA, or the National Telecommunications and Information Administration.
So federal organization.
That's right. It's part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. So these folks are the folks who review the rules. So there's a lot of hyperbole here about giving over control of the Internet. What we're really talking about here is a bureaucratic, administration, procedural type change. So ICANN has been administering this area for a long time.
Why? Why has the U.S. been the administrator of Internet domain names and numbers?
Well, the Internet originated here. Our government was influential in the start of the Internet. People like John Postel and Vint Cerf have been involved in this stuff for a long time.
And Al Gore.
Al Gore, right. So, you know, for a long time, it's been under the Department of Commerce. Now, to the U.S.'s credit, ICANN's been around and it has a lot of representatives there that are outside the U.S. So we've really been the sponsor, the person who delegated the authority to ICANN in the first place. So I wouldn't say the U.S. has been very active in sticking its nose in this area anyway.
Has it ever had to intervene for any reason?
In the early days, setting up a lot of the rules about how the DNS system works and who's allowed to run these root servers and the top-level domain servers, sure. But those rules have been around for a long time. So really what's happening is the U.S. Department of Commerce is saying, look, ICANN, you've been running this for a long time. We've been delegating to you for a long time. Guess what? You're the authority now. You no longer work for us. Run it yourself. So I think what ICANN's going to do is they're going to bring in a number of people, as they always have, to help review these rules. But we have to remember, these are really – this organization is an organization that decides what the rules are. They generally delegate the physical running of the servers and what's in the domains to other companies and countries, et cetera. So, you know, if you run Brazil – Brazil is responsible for what's inside its domain, not the U.S.
So they cannot shut off the internet, so to speak. ICANN doesn't have that kind of power.
ICANN doesn't run those servers. They delegate those servers to lots of companies. For example, the root servers on the internet are run by places like the ISC, which is a nonprofit. The University of Maryland runs one of them. There are root servers in all kinds of countries all over the place. It's distributed. There are hundreds and hundreds of these machines run by dozens of different organizations. So yes, the contents of what goes into those root servers and the requirements of who's allowed to run those, yes, ICANN says who those people can be and how they can run those servers.
Well, all right. The Obama administration's decision to give up control of the authority for domain names.
Yes.
It's been kind of red meat for a lot of conservatives. I've read a lot of heated language from online trolls about the decision. Now, what's the big concern exactly? And is there any real reason to be worried?
I think this is really minor. I think ICANN has been a multi-stakeholder organization that's been reporting into the Department of Commerce for many years. I think its need to do that going forward is minimal to none. So I think that the panic here is really over a simple bureaucratic administrative change. I think if folks want to worry about their day-to-day use of the internet, there are plenty of other issues in the media for you to concentrate on besides a simple administrative change here.
But this is also coming right around the time that there's a lot of geopolitical maneuvering going on in the larger sphere. You know, we're talking about what's going on in Russia and Crimea and the Ukraine, for example. There have been a lot of statements about giving up control of ICANN, posing a threat to national security. So what's the argument there? I guess you're not taking that one very seriously.
That's a tough argument. I mean, if you want to be worried about things like, well, should the .photos domain be allowed, or the .clothing domain, or the .guru domain, or .some other domain being allowed to be on the internet or not, and you think that's a matter of national security, okay. I don't really think so. So I think there's a lot of fluff here. There's a lot of meat there. When you spin this into giving up control of the internet to who knows who, that definitely strikes a lot of fear. But the reality is the internet's been distributed since day one. We talked on this show about when Syria shut down their portion of the mm-hmm. internet. We've talked about the great firewall over in China. We've talked about all kinds of areas that show absolute facts that areas of the internet are under control of other people besides the U.S.
Realistically, can everyday internet users expect their online experience to change in the short term or the long term when this ICANN transition is made?
I think you should expect your online internet to change constantly, as it always has. But I don't think it has anything to do with who's running ICANN. I think ICANN will continue to operate as it always has for the last decade or two. But things like mergers of large ISPs, there's a big merger proposed between Time Warner Cable and Comcast. There's been a lot of discussion of the T-Mobile Sprint merger. I mean, although those are wireless people, they're actually internet providers now, right? I mean, all of our smartphones are internet devices. Those types of mergers and acquisitions and ownership by foreign companies, if you want to put your tinfoil hat on and worry about things, those are great topics to worry about because those are real. Those are real things that are being proposed and considered.
I think this ICANN decision sometimes gets conflated with net neutrality, like who controls the internet, who controls what people can see on the internet. So my question to you, what is more concerning, the ICANN decision, the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger, or threats to net neutrality?
I think the ICANN issue is probably the least concerning. There was something recently that kind of went by a lot of people's eyes, and that was Netflix recently paid Comcast for preferred or high-quality access to Comcast customers. So that was a really interesting situation. Here you have a private company that provides movies paying one internet provider for access. So just think about that. What does that mean to Virginia Prescott and her website? Should she have to pay internet providers so people can access her website? It's a very interesting debate there about net neutrality. Should that payment have been allowed? What is Netflix getting for that money? And what does that mean to other companies? So I think that the debate about net neutrality will continue. I think it's a great debate. I think it's more concerning when you start talking about mergers of larger and larger companies. I hearken back to the days I hate to date myself, but when we all had landline wired phones and AT&T was the monopoly. And that broke up. But that monopoly had a lot of restrictions on it. For example, AT&T, because of their monopoly, was forced by the government to wire up very remote areas of our country that clearly weren't profitable. I mean, they said to AT&T, hey, up here in New England, you got to run your telephone lines up into very northern Maine and, you know, hook up the 10, 20, 30, 100 people up in northern Maine over these mountains. And of course, that was a very unprofitable thing for AT&T to do. They're never going to make that money back deploying that infrastructure. But they did it because they were a monopoly. So now we're getting into the situation where you have private companies that aren't under the control of the U.S., that don't have any of these regulations telling them where and who they have to connect, are becoming so large and so powerful, they're approaching monopolies. So that's a bit concerning to me when you allow a very small set of companies to have basically monopolistic access to all of us and yet little to no oversight by the government.
Well, Rob Fleischman, thank you for setting us at ease. Glad we'll be seeing you again because the internet won't be breaking anytime soon.
Wonderful being here, Virginia.
Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at ZeroCoal. He's also our explainer here at Word of Mouth of all things Wired. You can take a look at an ICANN explainer and view some of the concerns of those opposing the U.S. government ceding control of ICANN. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. While how the internet operates is out of our power, one thing we can control is our body and what happens to it when our number is called, be it buried or cremated or donated for organs or other study. How would you feel about donating your body to the study of decomposition? Up next, we're going to hear the curious story of a body farm. That's where forensic anthropologists team up with law enforcement to pinpoint exactly what happens to human remains in a variety of conditions. It takes a donation of far less gravity to keep NHPR thriving. All of the content you hear is made possible because of you. Maybe you contribute directly through your feedback, your ideas, or by calling into The Exchange or The Diane Rehm Show. We're hoping you can support NHPR financially as well. Please call now to ensure that programming that piques at your sense of wonder and your curiosity about innovations continues on NHPR, as well as all the other news and information programming that you get. Here's how.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
So what do we got here?
Not much so far. Severely charred body. Local PD says no one witnessed anything.
So far I found blowflies. No eggs or larvae, so I can't determine time of death.
Based on the nasal root and the brow ridge, the victim is a Caucasian male. Don't step in the brain, Booth.
Brain? Ah, what?
That was a clip from the hit TV show Bones, which debuted in 2005 on Fox and has helped popularize the science behind forensic anthropology for a generation of TV watchers. While the flashy technology and grisly scenes uncovered on the show may be fictional, a good portion of the underlying science is real. So how do real-life forensics teams learn how to identify bodies and estimate times of death? And who pioneered such morbid techniques? Renee Ebersol is features editor at Audubon Magazine and a contributor to Mental Floss, where she wrote about the Body Farm. It's one of four such facilities in the country where forensic anthropologists and police investigators learn firsthand how to read a body. Renee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Body Farm is just a nickname. The site is part of the University of Tennessee's Forensic Anthropology Center. Generally speaking, what kinds of things go on there?
Well, primarily, they've looked at the science of decomposition, and they're really a pioneer in that science. Since the 1980s, they've been looking basically at everything that goes into decomposition, and they are responsible for some of the techniques that help pinpoint time of death in every case around the world.
So what are some of the ways in which they stage decomps to be studied?
Well, it's a three-acre facility, a woodland facility, and they take donated cadavers and they position them in the way that you might find them in a crime scene.
So shallow graves, maybe in the trunk of a car, that kind of thing?
Exactly. Anything that you might find that a forensic scientist might encounter in the field.
So estimating the time of death, I guess that's an essential part, as I understand it, of the forensic field.
It really is. I mean, if you've watched Bones or CSI or Law and Order or any of those TV shows that often open with a dead body, you know, it's the same thing. TV speeds it up dramatically, but really what they're looking for initially is that time of death that helps investigators build a timeline. And without the time of death, you know, they would really be groping for where to start.
I was reading this and thinking, gosh, how do they start in a facility like this? And you answer that question in your article. Give us a little bit of an origin story. Can you run through that for us?
Sure. It goes back to a man named Bill Bass, who studied, well, he was at the University of Tennessee when, I'm working with the medical examiner's office, when police were coming to him and saying, you know, we have this body, can you tell us when this person died? And he really had no scientific basis for that. He looked into the academic literature and he couldn't find anything to be able to accurately give them information. So he decided that he needed to study it. And he went to the dean at the University of Tennessee and said, I need some land to put some bodies on. And the dean, you'd think that maybe the dean would laugh him out of the office, but the dean actually said, you know, head over to the agricultural campus and talk to them. And it turned out that there was a piece of land back behind the medical center that hadn't been used. It was weedy and a woodland, and they decided that that would be a good place for him to start doing his work.
Wow. Who studies there?
The students from the anthropology program there, the forensic anthropology program there, and then they have crime scene investigators come as well. The FBI comes and trains there, and basically they come in and look at a potential crime scene. They look at a body that's decomposing, and they work it as if they would a crime scene. And I think recently the FBI is doing some work with facial recognition.
How do they get the cadavers?
People donate them.
To this specifically? I mean, I would think that maybe you think you're donating your body to science. You know, it might be to study the vascular system, not necessarily have your body thrown in the trunk of a car to see how it weathers in the summer.
Yeah, they donate specifically to the facility. If you go to their website, there's a couple pages there about how you can donate. They have about 100 people who donate their bodies every year. They currently have 1,000 people at the, you know, at the facility. I'm sure that they're not all on the ground. Almost 3,000 people have signed up. They've pre-registered to have their bodies donated to the body farm.
What sorts of techniques has this site and others like it helped forensic scientists, law enforcement to understand over the years?
Well, the time of death is really important. They use insects. That's one of the keys to determining time of death. They found that basically you can track time of death by looking at the life cycle of a fly. So when the flies are drawn to a dead body, they begin their very predictable life cycle. And when you factor in the conditions for weather and sunlight and temperature, once you look at those variables, you can go back and figure out what happened. The other things that they're doing more recently is they're looking at laser technology called LIDAR, and this is really cutting-edge technology. They're using the technology to figure out how a landscape changes as a body decomposes.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with the current technology that researchers are trying to use, satellite technology, do not penetrate the canopy. You really can't see what's going on below the forest canopy. So you could have grave sites down there that you've absolutely no idea exist. And LIDAR technology can penetrate the canopy and pick up very subtle changes in the landscape. And that's how their hypothesis that they'll be able to use this technology to figure out if there's a mass grave site there.
Uh-huh. So if you're looking in a conflict zone, Yugoslavia or something like that, and looking for mass graves, LIDAR technology would actually help you, what, be able to identify different plants grow there? What kind of changes are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So there are a lot of conflict areas where genocide has happened. Yugoslavia, Argentina, Uganda, Guatemala. If this is effective, they'll be able to look down at the forest and detect differences in the vegetation. So when a body decomposes, the nutrients in the soil become very rich so that plant life can come in there, particularly the weedy plant life comes in first and grows up. You can tell that there's a change in the composition of the foliage on the forest floor. And then they're adding to that, they're looking at thermal technology where you would be able to, the hypothesis is that you would be able to see the heat coming, radiating out from an area where there's a grave site.
Wow, fascinating stuff. Renee Ebersole, features editor at Audubon Magazine. She wrote Welcome to the Body Farm. It's about the facility that's part of the University of Tennessee's Forensic Anthropology Center. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You can read Renee's article in the latest issue of Mental Floss. All of the contributors, all of the conversations, everything you hear on NHPR is brought to you by you. It is listener support that allows us to present not only quality news and analysis, but programs that speak to your sense of curiosity and your wonder at the world. If you rely on New Hampshire Public Radio to shed a little light on some new corners or new happenings in the world, please let us rely on you with your listener support. Here's how you can help.